Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Jill Wadey, Assistant Professor in UNCW's Sociology and Criminology Department, and Evan Folds, President of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. We're talking about how to increase access to healthy food, particularly for those who struggle with food insecurity. If you have a question for our guest today, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send your question in via email at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at CoastlineHQR. And Jill Wadey, just in terms of this area and the state, how are we doing? Where do we rank in terms of food insecurity?
Unfortunately, North Carolina ranks fifth in the nation in terms of level of food insecurity. In the United States in 2013, the food insecurity rate was 14.3%, meaning 14.3% of Americans were either worried about where their next meal was coming from, running out of food, skipping meals, not eating for a whole day, losing weight because they didn't have enough money to afford food. North Carolina is much higher at 17.3%. As I said, we're fifth after Arkansas, Mississippi, Texas, and Tennessee. So we have pretty high rates of food insecurity, which is similar to our rate of poverty compared to the rest of the country, too.
So you're saying the reason that we're fifth in the nation in terms of food insecurity is because we have a high rate of poverty?
It's definitely one of the main reasons. Poverty and food insecurity don't correlate exactly. You could be poor and have plenty to eat. You could be living above the poverty line and still be food insecure, but they're definitely related, and I think that's probably one of the reasons. In North Carolina and, you know, all of the issues we had with loss of jobs in the region, all these different issues contribute to that. And these persistent poverty counties, right? So Blaine, Columbus, and Robeson have higher food insecurity rates than even our North Carolina average.
So what are some of the other issues that would create a food insecure situation in someone's life?
Not having geographic access to food. If you not only are low income, but if you live in one of these food deserts, that's really associated with being food insecure. You know, maybe being elderly, not having access to transportation. A lot of these things definitely go together.
You're listening to Coastline, talking about food insecurity in the region. And Edwanda from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Or do I have Lewis from Wilmington?
Hello?
Hello.
How you doing? This is Lewis.
Hi, Lewis. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. One problem I've noticed is even though people would like to eat healthier, even if they have access, I know a lot of people have trouble with affordability. And with the problems in California and whatnot, it just seems like it's going to go up in price. And is there any kind of strategies or thinking involved to try to help get the price down for some of these people who would like to eat healthy, but they just can't simply afford it?
Evan Folds.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it speaks kind of to the crux of what we're talking about. It's not black and white. But I think the problem, first of all, is access. I think price is a factor there. But a lot of the food that we see, the price that we are experiencing is, you know, 60% of the average food product you buy in the grocery store is not food. It's the 1,500 miles of travel to get there. It's the marketing. It's the, you know, the packaging that it's in. It's everything but the food. So what we're trying to do locally, which I think the answers are locally, we're not going to get rescued by anyone from outside. They may make it easier on us. But what we're really trying to do is create a model that lives within itself that can deliver food at a price point that would be better than what you would see in the average grocery store that's grown locally. And I think part of that is what I was referencing earlier is really an intention to do that because the economics is such. And I don't have the firm grasp that I'd like yet, but we're working towards it. But as we develop this data and we actually look at the real business model of what our costs were and the value of what it was that we grew, we can then get a better understanding of how to create a model out of it that we can apply to space. It could be a rooftop, could be a backyard, it could be 20 acres, it could be anywhere. And if the model makes sense, then we can go and do it. And there would be nothing holding us back. So I think that's part of the answer. The other is making sure that we can have a policy that reinforces what we all want, and that's maybe a bigger animal than what we can do locally, I would argue.
Lewis, thanks so much for your call. And Edwanda from Wilmington says, this seems to be more than a nutritional issue and more political. Why would we have to think politically in a business manner in order to change and improve the way we eat? And I think this is touching on that same element of
the point you were just making, Evan Folds. And you also mentioned unconventional spaces for farming. And there seems to be some sort of a trend. I've heard of Freedom Lawns. I've heard of the Great Healthy Yard Project. What does this mean? Can people farm in their yards if they're living on a suburban tract of land?
Absolutely. Our version, we call it Food Lawns. And you can get a quick splash page at foodlawns.com. And we're going to develop a local website that tracks where the food is grown, where it ends up. Kind of create a party out of the idea that, you know, you can tell your neighbor you can go eat your foods at RX or Pembroke's or any of these restaurants in town, or Tidal Creek for that matter. So the problem is, and, you know, a way to make the point, I think, is in maybe every day, maybe every day this time of year, we get somebody from Ohio or New York that's moved into town that had really good soil where they were that they could take for granted, and they're doing exactly what they did at home, and they do it here, and the plant dies. And that's very common. And the reality is the development of property pretty much obliterates any kind of healthy soil that could be there to begin with, even if it was developed 50 years ago. It takes 1,000 years to make an inch of soil. So it's by law you have to bring in 4 inches of fill, and the general contractor could care less about mineral balance and biological diversity. So the reality is you don't really have soil. You got dirt. It's kind of a simple way of thinking about it. So until you kind of get on that path of growing your soil, you really can't have the success that you want. Container gardening, hydroponics are very accessible options. But at the end of the day, our Food Lawns program intends to be, you know, you can do all of this yourself with our help, or we can do it all for you and come to farm your landscape for you with levels of entry in between. And, you can get involved in your local food system by growing the food or simply by eating it, you know, and create kind of an awareness towards that. And then options people can proactively lean into getting involved is what our efforts are. But, you know, people ask, what can I do in my landscape? And there's two things. One is start a compost pile. It's free. We'll give you the compost tea for free to inoculate it. And it grows soil. So that's a very accessible option, and everybody's got food waste and organic waste. And the second is just to grow one thing that you can eat. You know, even if it's just a pepper plant and you can, you know, slice the banana pepper up and put it on your salad, that simple effort and experience of eating something that you've grown is really an intangible. You know, you can't talk about it. It's an experience. And you know, the whole idea that the food you grow makes it taste better, it really does. And that's really kind of what starts the fire. And then from there, when you have success in one little thing, you can – it's just a matter of doing it again in a different way.
Or failure. We had a spring gardening show a couple of weeks ago, and we had some very experienced local gardeners who are used to this climate and, you know, the stuff that we walk around on, the dirt and the sand. And they both threw up their hands when it came to tomatoes and said, "We're not even talking about tomatoes."
Well, I would have liked to have been on that show because I could help them with that.
Tell us about that. Tell us about how, for instance, and I've known other people too who've said, tried tomatoes, they get to a certain point, and then the squirrels get them, the birds get them, or the tomato hornworms come.
Yeah, well, you got to grow enough for the pests. And so if you have a good crop, that tends to work itself out. But
really?
No, yeah, it does.
Hold on that point for a second. Yeah. If you grow enough tomato plants, you won't just develop a larger crop of tomato hornworms?
No, well, the hornworms are a little different. There's easy ways to manage them. Bacillus thuringiensis is a beneficial bacteria. You spray that onto your plants weekly, bi-weekly, and when the hornworm eats the leaf, the bacteria grows in its gut and kills it from the inside, and it's completely organic. So, you know, there's ways like that in almost every pest, but the reality is most pests outside of maybe deer, which maybe need to be physically restrained if it's a really bad problem or you're on the deer highway, which some people are, but most pests, moles, chinch bug, ground pearl, all of these things that we are told can't be killed by chemicals are all obliterated by having the soil be alive. And you want to think about, you know, in the forest, the trees don't eat the leaves. They eat what microbes make out of it. That's composting. Equally, the forest grows trees, huge trees, with no fertilizer because the soil is alive and it's organized, it's mature. So what we do conventionally when we grow gardens is, you know, we may go get some Miracle-Gro or something artificial that might grow the plant with some success, but that is working against the life in the soil. And that's really a simple takeaway from this conversation is organic gardening is not just good for the earth. It's the intention of organic gardening is to feed microbes, but the microbes have to be there to be fed. And you want to think about it, it's kind of like adding the yeast to make the bread. You know, try drinking a beer without yeast. It defines the process, right? So that transformation of organic matter, the leaves in a forest, into plant food doesn't just happen, or it doesn't just melt. It has to be accomplished by diverse microbes.
So can you explain that issue? Because that's come up a few different ways. We've we've heard people say just going to get the big bag of Miracle-Gro to enrich your soil may have a short-term impact. But what does that really do? What's the effect?
Yeah, well, great question, because it draws a parallel in the whole conversation that we're having. Miracle-Gro is fast food for plants. It, you know, put numbers on it. A plant has to have 17 elements to grow. Those are called the essential elements. If one of those elements isn't present, the plant can't form. Miracle-Gro's got 7 elements at the most in it. So it's half, less than half of what the plant has to have. It's actually taking advantage of your soil, because when you run out and are deficient in the things you're not adding, all things fall apart, and that's pests and diseases. No different than what happens to us when we eat fast food for every meal. We make movies out of it, right? I mean, we've kind of sold ourselves on this idea that it's true for our own health, but we don't apply it to the soil, which, you know, ironically is what creates the fast food scenario that we're dealing with. So you kind of have this catch-22, and you really kind of have to think your way out of it, you know, what we think we grow. So if you're approaching your soil from a standpoint of mineral diversity and biological diversity, you can't help but grow healthier food, and that's going to reinforce the whole nature of the conversation that we're trying to have with the with our society, for that matter.
What kinds of food crops can we grow? Jill Wadey, what kinds of things are being grown in the community garden at Rankin Terrace, for instance?
Well, right now, it's at Hillcrest. Right now, it's just kale because of the way the season is. They're planning a big, like, planting day, I think, on May 1st, where they're going to put in some of the crops. I'm not sure what they've grown in the past. But they have that community garden. They have some gardens in schools through the Food Corps program. So they have people who are in this program where it takes recent college graduates, puts them in some of these low-income schools, teach classes about healthy fruits and vegetables, plants the garden with the students, you know, has them eat these, see how delicious it is right from the garden, stuff like that. So I'm not sure exactly what they're planting, but you're teaching children from a young age about these good foods.
Evan Folds, what do you think are good crops that people can plant in their yards and grow fairly easily here?
Whatever you like. You know, we live – it's interesting. We don't view ourselves as an agricultural community, but before 1960, we were the breadbasket of the South. You know, we have ideal growing conditions. We don't have ideal soil, but that can be handled very effectively. You know, we give compost tea away to anybody who's never tried it if they come into the store, and that's a way of growing your soil and starting to get these kinds of results. So as far as the crop, you would just want to look at the season that you're in, cold season, warm season crops. But you can actually have a year-round agricultural environment in your landscape in Wilmington. It's very conducive, much more so than most other places, actually. It's just a matter of getting the fundamentals right, of getting that soil right so that you can have success. The number one thing that's discouraging about gardening is you put all of the effort into it and nothing, you don't get anything out of it. You know, it's really difficult to do that year after year. So
the basis of that is the soil, and the compost is one of the best methods for enriching the soil. What are other things that people might need to do in a lot of the yards here southeastern North Carolina?
In simple terms, a lot of the technical nature of how we approach our landscapes, which we learn by researching it through kind of the expert channels, it's a bit, you know, I'm in no way picking on doctors because I know a lot of very brilliant and qualified they're all well-meaning, but the reality is doctors are trained to manage symptoms. They're not trained to heal people. And, you know, they don't ask people to change their diets in the same way that they'll prescribe a pill to alleviate the symptom. And so there's no judgment there. That's their job. So what we're kind of talking about is not taking the pill. Don't go kill the pest. It's the pest doing what it's supposed to do. It's trying to put your plants out of misery because they're sick. You know, the soil's bad. Disease is no different. We just talked about that a minute ago. Incidentally, weeds are medicinal herbs. You know, you could buy them at Tidal Creek if you wanted to for your health, and they're trying to do the same thing for the landscape. So you can kind of see, you know, not going too past the surface there, that the perspective that you hold really drives the action that you undertake. And if you try to kill your problem, you're making it worse. So you take a step back, you introduce, you know, think about the ocean. The strength is of the food web is in the diversity, and that's really the same way in the soil.
Jill Wadey, just a couple of minutes left. If you were queen of the world, how would you like to see public policy change to address some of these food access, healthy food access issues?
It's difficult. I think it has to start on the community level, and that's what this great program, Feast Down East, is doing through a food sovereignty program. So they're engaging with people who are food insecure about getting their own access. So the fresh food markets in Rankin Terrace and Hillcrest, residents actually run them with help from one of our Vista volunteers. But that's really important to get the community involved and not just, you know, here you go, but having them involved in getting their own access to these issues. Other things for farmers markets, especially getting them all to have access to a card reader so people can bring their SNAP benefit cards and use that in order to purchase some of these fresh fruits and vegetables.
Is that something that can happen now or not the case?
Yeah. So a lot of farmers markets in the country do have that. I'm not sure about the one in Wilmington because I just moved here, like I was saying. But some places will even double your SNAP dollars. So if you go there, you can get twice as much money to buy fruits and vegetables at the farmers market. So those are some really great ideas to try to get people better access.
Evan Folds, final thoughts.
Oh, well, first, you know, I just would really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these kinds of things to a wider group of people. But I would really challenge people to think strongly about what they want to see in regards to their food system and the way in which we engage it and the buying power that we enlist and the means in which we involve ourselves in that are really the fundamental tenets of what make it what we want. So we have the means to do it, and anybody who has an interest, you know, please do seek us out. We're open 7 days a week on Oleander Drive, and we'd love to talk with you about it and get you involved.
Well, that's this edition of Coastline, and I'd like to thank both of our guests, Jill Wadey of UNCW and Evan Folds of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. Thanks also to you, our listeners, those of you who emailed and called in. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Join us for the next Coastline. Seismic testing off the North Carolina coast is the next step towards offshore drilling. We'll hear about potential impacts on marine life from a scientific perspective. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.